Dan Levitard, if we're really being honest about it, it's just a giant piece of shit.
To the Big Suey.
Bald Eagles.
A podcast exclusive that none of our bosses asked for.
More sports.
More work. Less pay.
I haven't stopped talking in a month. I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
Just when you thought the show couldn't be more diluted. Bam.
Last time I listened to this show.
I haven't listened for years.
Now here's the marching band to nowhere.
Am I missing something? What am I missing?
The end of the story.
Fat face.
Chris Fallick.
It's Felica. You made him a penis.
And the habitual liar.
I didn't ask for any of it.
You asked for all of it.
The Big Suey.
I'm Chris Cody, BSPN.
So, Bomani, you had a parting shot that you did about LeBron and how LeBron could never be Ali. And a lot of people came after you, as they do come after me when I offer, you know, a criticism or two of LeBron James. It becomes that I'm a hater. How did that one go over? And can you just tell the people who didn't hear the parting shot what it is you were trying to do with the parting shot?
Yeah. So my point was, and I do believe that, I think LeBron has done a lot of great work, and I think that we have given him a lot of praise for the great work that he has done, and deservedly so. Like, the man opened a school, right? But opening a school and that stuff, that's a real rich people play, right? As well, he should make a rich people play, as he is, in fact, a rich person. Like, he can do those things. But I have felt, and you can look at that with his production company doing like that Muhammad Ali documentary, and he's been, you know, leaned heavy in like the More Than Athlete and all of that stuff. I do believe that he has tried to position himself as like the Muhammad Ali of his time. He wants to be seen not simply as someone who is working toward good causes, but as someone who is at the front of these things, right? LeBron, and a whole lot that LeBron does where he's just a passenger on it, right? And, you know, he's been showing up to the arena and like the leader to society shirt. And I'm like, nobody gets to anoint themselves a leader, right? And that happens in basketball a lot, where people will tell you, like Giannis did this, like when they decided they weren't going to play that game after Jacob Blake was shot. And he's like, you know, I'm the leader of the team, and this is what the leader does. No, you don't anoint yourself to leadership. And my point really, though, about Ali was, the Ali that we talk about as being a social conscience of sorts was the 21, 22, 23-year-old Muhammad Ali. Muhammad Ali in his 30s is doing business with Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines and with Mobutu in Zaire. Muhammad Ali in his 40s is endorsing Orrin Hatch and says that's his favorite politician ever because he wants to put God in schools. You know, now Ali, of course, himself was just a bit scattershot on some of these things. But the energy that really drives those kinds of movements typically comes from younger people. Like, it's more likely that somebody like Jaylen Brown would be the guy at the front of that than it would be LeBron James, because that's just how these things work over and over again and across the board. You can go look at him. Even Martin Luther King dealing with Stokely Carmichael was, you know, a younger person was fueling the energy toward the late 60s, you know, once we got there. And so I said this about LeBron, just like, yo, you're not going to be Muhammad Ali and showing yourself reading the autobiography of Malcolm X and stuff like that. That ain't doing much for me, to be perfectly honest. Like, I think there's roles that you can play, and I think that he plays the role of a very rich guy who cares a lot in these things. But when the guys had decided that they weren't going to play and LeBron didn't like that, and then they're like, well, you know, we talked to Barack Obama about it. Well, of course, Obama's going to say you guys need to hurry up and play, because Obama would have never made that decision in the first place. Now, I thought they should have gone ahead and played. Don't get me wrong, but Ali was a revolutionary type. Right. Ali was a radical. And I had some people push back on me at the idea of calling Ali radical, but I don't use that as a pejorative term. He was a radical. That's not what LeBron is. Like, these initiatives about pushing voting, they're very good. And I think they should do that. But look what's happening all over the place now, where you got the crazy long lines for people trying to vote and stuff like that, for example. And in California, where you had the misleading ballot boxes that were put up. Right. Like, LeBron is pushing for change within the system that is totally different than Colin Kaepernick, who advocates for change that is an alteration and in some ways a destruction of the system as it exists. And so I don't knock LeBron for the things that he is doing. I just think the things that he does need to be put into a proper context. And I do personally wish that he was a bit less self-aggrandizing about his role in these things.
Well, the risk, Bomani, is not nearly the same. The things that Muhammad Ali risked were real and heavy and wasn't the behavior of a rich man. But I have marveled at the voice that LeBron has developed over the last 10 years. When you go back to Trayvon Martin wearing a hoodie, that at the time for LeBron James was radical, and he has absolutely found his voice with power and championships and success, where he's not really risking very much of anything in some of the things that he's advocating for.
Yeah, well, that thing in 2012 is huge. Keep in mind, he hadn't even won a title yet, right? Like, this is not even a year after what happened in Dallas against the Mavericks, and we got all the bad things in the world to say about LeBron when that happened. Like, that was big. I was like legitimately choked up at that point, because that was such a strong statement from an entire basketball team in a way that I don't recall seeing previous to that. Like, and that's the thing I always want to be clear about with LeBron, is I have a great admiration for a lot of the things that he has done, right? And the things that he's been willing to do, but he's also made some business decisions along the way. And I don't blame him for that. Like, as you said, the risk for him is not the same at this point. And he's got a lot more to lose. He's got a lot more to take care of. He's got a lot more people who are depending on him. And look, Ali had the Nation of Islam behind him. LeBron's got Nike behind him. Those are two different organizations, right? And they're going to encourage you to do things in two completely different ways. And so I'm down to give him props for what he does. I don't like, though, and I guess for me, it's kind of a double-edged sword for him, in that he gets so much attention for being LeBron James, and that's part of why it's so good when he does anything, because there's so much attention on him. But you can't do these things for the attention. Like, the question becomes with LeBron, are you leveraging the attention that you always get, or are you courting attention for yourself? And that line for me has been a little bit blurry at some points this year.
What can you tell the people who are too young to remember what Joe Morgan meant at a different time in sports? Baseball was king. He was an unusual-looking second baseman with power at the center of one of the most famous lineups baseball has ever had. He passed away this week. He was also, to another generation, he was the voice of baseball, and then the voice of baseball without analytics, where a lot of people made fun of him for not evolving with the times. The passing of Joe Morgan, how do you eulogize him?
Well, what's interesting about the analytics thing is that as a broadcaster, he is analogous to Charles Barkley in the sense that they are all-time greats who were not really on board with the modern paradigm of analyzing their sports. But their careers, the advanced numbers loved them. Like, with Barkley, in a way where even though Charles Barkley was a giant star when he played, the advanced numbers have kind of pointed out that he was actually even better than people realized he was. Joe Morgan, without question, is the best post-integration second baseman in baseball history. And the Big Red Machine, which I was obviously not alive to see, but definitely was alive at points to get the proper context on it, probably the best collection of baseball players that we have ever seen on a baseball team, just Hall of Famer after Hall of Famer after Hall of Famer. Like, Ken Griffey's daddy was a really good player, but like the seventh best player maybe on that team when they had that. And Joe Morgan was that guy. He and Johnny Bench, the two best players that were on that team. And I think with second baseman and middle infielders generally, but I think second baseman in particular, they're so much bigger now than they used to be. Like, physically, you would never have guys that were this size playing those middle infield positions back in the day. Like, playing second base and playing shortstop, the glove was most important, and if you could get a bat out of it, that would be fantastic.
Ain't that the truth? Second baseman could not hit. That's where you put the guy. That and shortstop is where you put the guy who could not hit.
Yes, second baseman hit second or eighth, right? Like, that was where they were in the lineup no matter what. And Joe Morgan had popped. Joe Morgan won two MVPs at second base. Like, he is one of the all-time great baseball players. And then, like, as you mentioned, I became familiar with him, obviously, as a broadcaster, because he was getting those gigs with Major League Baseball from my childhood all the way on. Like, he was that guy. But just do not ever get this twisted, no matter what you thought about him because of him being a broadcaster. And, I mean, somebody started a website called Fire Joe Morgan because they hated him so much as a broadcaster. But don't get this twisted, man. That is one of the greatest baseball players they had ever been. And at a time, you remember, we used to have a lot more distinct batting stances, right? He had that elbow twitch. That was his bag. Like, I feel like we don't have that so much anymore. People holding the bat in funny ways.
Can you explain to me how you reconcile the fact that you and I spend a good amount of time complaining about the injustice in college football, but where we work, we also get money, at least in part, from college football, and a few entities benefit more from the existence of college football than ESPN and ESPN's employees?
I mean, ESPN kind of owns college football in some ways. Like, I think I always point out to people, in bowl games and television shows, and this company owns a lot of them. I reconcile it by, honestly, you're not the major industrial operation with a heart of gold does not exist. It just doesn't, you know? And so, yeah, I have a lot of problems with the way that college football is run. I also think there's a greater value in me speaking on college football from somewhat of the inside than there is from the outside, right? Nobody would listen to anything I had to say about the infrastructure of college football if they would not listen to what I have to say about actual college football games and the likes, you know? And I still enjoy the games. I enjoy the absurdity of everything that surrounds college football, who's in charge and why, right? Like, I dig it. I have no problem admitting that I enjoy it while also having a problem with the ways that the players are treated. And that often gets tricky because a lot of the players don't have a problem with the way that they are treated. And I don't listen to that. I still have a problem for them, even if they are like, but I got this MacBook and I stay in a great dorm and everything else, right? Like, I still look at that and be like, yo, but there should be more for you. You know, we're still there. But I don't think it is difficult, or I don't think that being critical of the NCAA and the way things are done requires like somebody like me to set himself on fire, right? Like, it doesn't require me to quit my job in the name of solidarity of it, because once I do that, nobody gives a damn about what I have to say about any of those things.
So what do you do with Trump as a political tool saying he saved college football? He's taken credit for a lot of things that he can't take credit for. But on this one, I believe, I don't know if credit is the word that I want to use, but the SEC and the ACC went the way that they did for political reasons. And whatever's happening with the Big Ten seems to absolutely have been influenced by his pressure. So when he takes credit for saving college football, you do what with that?
I am not so sure that his pressure actually made anything happen, just because I don't know if at the point in time at which that happened, he was popular enough to really like sway anything from those folks. Like, keep it in mind that we had seen the month or so before, clearly across the board, major operations like not really caring what he thought with their embrace of Black Lives Matter and all of these sorts of things, right? Like, so I'm not so sure that Trump actually made this happen with the Big Ten.
It doesn't matter, though, Bo, whether he made it happen or not. It can look enough like it. Like, he can manipulate the pieces, whether it's factual or so, to play politics with it and make it hard to rebut.
Yeah, I think that he could make it hard to rebut, but I don't know if in the end that's going to have any true effect on what happens in this election. Like, I think he keeps, like, he threw it out at the debate. He's going to throw it out a lot, the idea that he brought back Big Ten football. Like, I think he can throw all that stuff around, but man, everything moves so fast now, and there's so many bigger fish to fry right now than anything close to that, that I don't, like, I think that he has injected himself into it, but I don't think that that's going to matter for the election. I don't think it mattered in terms of making things happen. I think what happened with the Big Ten was the Big Ten thought that when they said they weren't going to play, that nobody else was going to play. And then other people played. Now, I could make the argument that what has actually happened since people have started playing college football affirms the Big Ten's decision not to do this. Like, Vanderbilt tried to play a game last week with 56 scholarship players. They're not going to be able to play this week. We saw the University of Houston at one point have three straight games canceled because the other teams couldn't get enough people there. Baylor right now is dealing with an outbreak on their roster of guys with COVID, right? The Big Ten says they've got some super special testing program that's going to make it possible for them to do it. And if they can make it happen, then they should go ahead and make it happen. But what I think really happened there was three schools voted against playing this fall. I mean, voted for playing this fall. And one of them was Ohio State. And then once Ohio State started making that super push and they had their players out here making the push, you had people doing this marching and everything else, and all the hell came down on the new commissioner, right? All those presidents saw that heat that was coming from the people, and then they just left the commissioner out there to flounder. And they're like, all right, well, you know, you figure out what to do here. And then at that point, they were coming back. Like, I don't think there was any way around it after that point that they were going to wind up coming back. And so Trump can do a touchdown dance on this one, but he's not the one that brought this across the line, I don't think.
South Alabama, Bo, hasn't played a game in 3 weeks and is now playing Texas State because of an outbreak. Why? What are we doing? Like, what are we doing? Why do I actually understand, you know, the greed of risking young bodies because you want the SEC dollars. But South Alabama, Texas State, like, what are we doing?
That is where it gets wild, is the idea that people just feel like they have to have football no matter what. And I guess they got some financial considerations, too, because they got TV contracts that they have to fulfill, because that's what this is. It's just everybody doing the best they can to put these games on television. But I talked about this a little bit on the right time, and I want to bring this over here. Did you see this story from the New York Times this weekend about like COVID causing brain fog?
I have not seen that story.
Oh, my God. There are people who are reporting, like, one of the long-term things is, like, losing memory, being unable to remember things like what a toothbrush is called. You know, like a woman talking about how she just, like, she couldn't read. Like, she was just not able to consume, like, literally could not read. Like, 2-3 months after the fact, had the bosses telling her that she had to take 13 months of leave because she had not recovered. Like, we see these guys test positive and then come back, and we don't think anything else of it after it happens. The potential consequences of contracting this disease are so dire. Like, and the point I made is, like, can you imagine being at a point where suddenly you literally take leave of, like, your senses? Like, you know, we are people who operate with our brains. Can you imagine just all of a sudden your brain doesn't work the way that it used to? These people are saying that they feel like they have dementia trying to recover from COVID-19. Like it says here, confusion, delirium, and other types of altered mental function called encephalopathy have occurred during hospitalization for COVID-19 respiratory problems. And a study found such patients needed longer hospitalizations, higher mortality rates, and often couldn't manage daily activities right after hospitalization. Like, this ain't just some cough. And we are leading these kids out here, and we don't even know how long they're going to be shaking this kind of stuff off. When it happens, like, this is one woman said this here. She said, one morning, everything in my brain was white static. I was sitting on the edge of the bed, crying, feeling something's wrong. I should be asking for help, but I couldn't remember who or what I should be asking. I forgot who I was and where I was.
I don't know why it is South Alabama and Texas State. I know you said the television contracts, but I don't get some of the things that we're doing in sports, where Mullen is out here saying in our state, because it's always our state, as DeSantis runs around high-fiving people and not wearing a mask at the Trump rally, that Mullen's out here saying that he wants the swamp filled with people because he lost to Texas A&M.
90,000 people. Like, he says he wants, and by the way, you noticed that when they came back and asked him about it afterwards, he didn't really want to talk about it no more. Like, apparently somebody was like, dude, have you lost your mind? I am amazed. Especially when you talk about South Alabama and Texas State, I am just amazed that many kids are willing to play. That there are not, I'm still stunned that we have not loudly heard from a single organization or group of parents saying, what in the world are we doing here? Because look, man, everybody's like, well, this kid has a chance to go to the league. Most of these kids know they ain't got no damn chance to go to the league. And if they don't know that, I was assuming most of their parents know at these lower levels they don't have a chance to go to the league. Like, Alabama got 85 scholarship players. 30 of them are going to go to the league. And maybe I get why player 84 at Alabama thinks that he's going to go to the league. I do not understand why player 84 at Texas State is out there.
Oh, but I've talked to football players about something that I wouldn't understand, because you and I have talked before about, like, choosing to be a police officer, and that I don't have it in me to be a police officer. But I've stood on a sideline with Ricky Williams, Bomani, and he's looking at a field in retirement and saying, what the hell was I doing, because of the way the bodies are moving? That's Ricky Williams. Like,
yes.
And he talks about the warrior mentality, that you don't think of consequences. You can't play that sport thinking of consequences. You can't play that sport and Dak Prescott expects to be the guy taken off the field on a stretcher.
Do you remember the first time you were on the sideline?
It's terrifying.
And for me, that was at a Division II game. right? Like, we weren't even getting all the way up. It was at a Division II game. And I was like, what in the world? And I remember the first time I was on the sideline for a Division I game, and it involved a redshirt freshman named Mike Paulus, who was Greg Paulus' brother, and he had come in relief. North Carolina was playing against Virginia Tech, and so it's Bud Foster's defense against a guy who's never played football before. It was one of the most terrifying things I've ever seen. That dude was never right after that happened, and I could not blame him because I was like, why? How are they getting there so fast?
Can you tell me, speaking of the police, Bomani, a few years ago, I remember you asking, I don't know whether you've got an answer to this question, what the vetting process is for police officers, because how do you arrive in a place where you're selecting that as the job and you're that often behaving out of what feels like fear? Carl Douglas argues that police officers are usually action junkies, and then the excuse for wrong behavior becomes fear, but that what they're searching for is the action. Did you get an answer for what the vetting process is on police officers?
No, I did not get an answer, but I do think that there's kind of a range to this, right? I do think that some of those dudes are out there afraid. Like, there was a big story in New York a couple of years ago where this, I think he was Chinese, but it was an Asian gentleman who was a police officer, and he had gone into the Pink Houses, a housing project in Brooklyn, and shot somebody there. And of course, because he wasn't white, he did go to jail, right? Like, they sent him in, and there were a lot of protests that surrounded it. And the protests annoyed me on one level because it felt as though the Chinese community in New York, basically, their argument was, y'all don't send white people to jail for this, so why are you sending him to jail for this? As though he deserved the right to kill black people with impunity, right? Like, there's a whole range of issues that I had with that. But the point they made that was legitimate was it felt like they were sending the youngsters, like people who were not quite ready for such things, into some of these terrible neighborhoods. And then that dude is in there scared, and then he winds up shook and he shoots somebody. And the point I always make about that is, if you want me to give them room to be human and be afraid, that's fine. Just I can't do that and treat them like heroes at once, right? Like, a hero is not someone who is unafraid, but a hero is someone, at least in the way that we typically use it in these contexts, who rises above that fear, maintains himself or herself, and then, you know, keeps it going and does what's supposed to be done. But we can't make them heroes, and then when they mess up and kill somebody, just be like, oh, hey, man, you know, you got to understand, they were afraid. You would be afraid too. Yeah, that's why I don't work there. Like, hey, never been a time that you gone to a restaurant and they messed up your food, and a dude was like, well, you know, I would have done the same thing. No. Like, that's not the defense for professionals when they don't do their jobs in the ways that they should. And so, yeah, there's room to be afraid, and it makes you human to be afraid. And I get all of that, but you can't be a police officer if you're scared of being a police officer. Like, that's the whole thing. Like, what they're telling me they're afraid of is their jobs. And to me, at least, it can't be that.
Lightening it up a little bit, as a fan of both laughing and music, what did you like best about Saturday Night Live? Was it Jack White or was it Bill Burr?
I didn't even get to Jack White, though I enjoy Jack White. I saw him in concert a couple of years ago. That's a funny story in and of itself, but I enjoyed him greatly in concert. Bill Burr. So I have met Bill Burr. I did an interview with Bill Burr on the radio in 2008, the summer of 2008. And I'm like the fill-in guy on Afternoon Drive in Raleigh. And I'm talking to Burr because we had a deal with the local comedy club. So, you know, whoever's coming would, you know, come on. And he's like, yeah. But Obama, you got to vote for him, right? And I had to tell him, I was like, hey, man, I got to come back here tomorrow. You know what I'm saying? Like, you get to go back to wherever you are after you do your little comedy gig. I got to come back here tomorrow. You are not putting me in this bag. And he went out there and he told that joke about white women. And man, oh, man, the uncomfortable laughter in that theater as people tried to figure out whether or not it was funny, except it was. It was uproarious. There was no way around it. And then I said on Twitter the next morning, I was like, "Ooh, time for them searching for Bill Burr's wife to go through the roof." Because Bill Burr married to a black woman, which, I mean, gotta admit, a little surprising for that dude from Boston. I don't care if he hangs out with Chappelle or not, right? Not everybody saw that one coming. And yeah. Bill Burr, one thing I do feel like, as a white man, once you are married to a black woman, you may recontextualize white women in a way that you never had before. You're going to hear some perspectives that have not been offered to you.
Bomani, previously. I thought that that's where that came from. I thought that Bill Burr's part of the routine, given that he has sharpened and sculpted, I'm the guy who doesn't give a bleep, and I'm going to do the performance art of not giving a bleep and also watch white women react to white women humor the way that I am saying that they will react. I thought that was absolutely born, not of Boston, not of the misogyny that you so often find with the Boston meathead, but that the fact that he is married to a black woman and can has to listen to that perspective.
Yeah, I don't think he would have told that joke 15 years ago, right? Like, I don't think he would have quite been ready or able to, and he dropped it masterfully. Like, I saw something on Twitter where somebody said that he was walking around in New York the week of, like, and he workshopped the routine with people on the street, you know, because comics, one point comics make about the comedy club and why they have such a problem with people like showing up with video cameras and stuff is they got to figure out tone. You can only figure out tone in front of people. And sometimes you're going to get the tone wrong as you try to figure out what the tone is that you need to have in your routine. And so he went on the streets to figure it out and he nailed it. He just absolutely nailed it. And I just, when the people didn't know whether to laugh, it was like,
so many people in there. So many people did not know whether to laugh.
And it was deep in there. Like, it's not like, I think I saw something that said that Saturday Night Live is like giving people, paying them like extras. And yes, that way they can get around some of the stuff.
Yes.
But it wasn't like there weren't people there. There were people there. You heard them laugh early, and then it got late. And what the best part also about Burr is, Burr is the type of comedian where when they have that kind of reaction, that's not going to stop him. He's like, yes, mission accomplished.
Well, I love that part of him so much because I hear so many comedians now, Bo, just they won't shut up about how difficult it is to do comedy in this climate. And guys like Chappelle, the guys who are best at it are A, they like the challenge of it, and B, they end up doing it well because they're like, that's the point of jokes. I'm defending comedy here to be able to go up against the edge. I'm just telling jokes.
Yeah, the ethos of comedians is the only thing that matters is if it's funny. Like, that's what they're going for. They're willing to ignore a lot of things if it's funny. Now, I contend that Dave Chappelle needs to approach that a bit differently than even Bill Burr does. And Bill Burr is a big star. But like with Dave Chappelle, when you tell jokes about transgender people, it means something different. It lands something different. It goes to different places. You are viewed as a modern philosopher of sorts with people. And so there is a more damaging effect for when you get these things wrong in those settings, right? But I also understand their argument. Like my man Felonious Monk made this point on Twitter. He was like, you paid your money to come in here. You knew what this was when you walked in. You know, and of course, there are lines to it. But I have found the comedians that we have a problem with for being racist, for being misogynist, whatever it may be, they generally have one thing in common. Like Andrew Dice Clay jumps out as an immediate example. He wasn't funny. Like, the problem with Andrew Dice Clay was that the only thing for him was, ha-ha, laughing at women. Ha-ha, laughing at black people. But it wasn't actually funny. It
wasn't clever either.
Right, exactly. Like, if you figure out how to make it funny and clever, you can go. Now, with Burr, like, the thing he did at Saturday Night Live didn't even fall under the heading of things that you, like, need to worry about or whatever it is. But I always thought that the conversations around Dave Chappelle were less conversations about comedy than conversations about what it means to be Dave Chappelle and what is your responsibility. And that is not the same responsibility as someone, you know, playing at 1 o'clock in the morning at the Comedy Cellar.
He's the person I most want to talk to in entertainment because I've found Chappelle's entire journey, not just because I want to laugh. I've just found there's so much wisdom in what he's experienced and how he's experienced it. And when I watch back rooting for things that I thought were great, whether it's Richard Pryor or Eddie Murphy or George Carlin or wherever it is you put the top of the food chain in stand-up comedy, man, Eddie Murphy stuff, that does not hold up in today's climate, like in any way at all.
Well, I watched Delirious a few months ago for the first time in years. All right. And the stuff about gay people is the one that jumps off the page. And he's done a measure of apology of that. But the one that got me in that routine was at some point he says something to the effect of, and women these days, they get mad if you slap them. Like it was, but it told me less about Eddie Murphy than it did about the times. Like there was a real uncomfortable thing when he's using the F word talking about gay people. When he talked about slapping your girlfriend, people just kind of laughed and went along with that, right? And then he starts like that. Part of the success of Eddie Murphy is the fact that he is a product of a three-channel universe, which is to say that the references that he was making were references that everybody could get because everybody was watching the same shows. So black comedian Eddie Murphy telling jokes about the Honeymooners is telling jokes that everybody can get. There aren't really a lot of analogous things now that you could just throw out there as I'm going to tell a joke about this and literally every person is going to be get it. So he was able to be like really inclusive in the frame of reference because the country's frame of reference was a lot more narrow. But that also meant like the Honeymooners, so many of the jokes on the Honeymooners are about, I ought to hit you in the face. Ralph Kramden saying that to his wife, you know, like it's they're just things that we're not tolerating you doing. So I would say that just because it's funny to tell a joke about beating your wife. No, we're not going to go with that. Right. Like there are clearly lines that are in place. But for the comic, it's going to be, is it funny? And if you can find a joke that's so funny that it overcomes the horror of talking about beating your wife, then they're going to ride with it. That's what it's always going to be. I don't know what joke is that funny, but that's what they're going to do.
I'm not prisoner of the moment when I say Chappelle's the best to ever do it. No,
I think there's an argument for it, right? Like I think he's way up there and he's got a particular style. Like I've seen him live now like four or five times. Like I model the way that I make content after the way Dave Chappelle made that television show and made Dave Chappelle's Block Party, that documentary. Like that is the push and the inspiration and like the intellectual underpinning of all the things I do, of how to code things in ways that multiple people can hear them, and the vision that if this is good enough and it's a good enough time that people will let go of whatever nonsensical hangups they have and they'll be able to consume it. Right. Like I view him in a different way, but like as a stand up comic, yeah, you're talking about him. You talk about Eddie Murphy. You talk about Richard Pryor. You talk about George Carlin. Like that's a rarefied air that those guys are in. And also, by the way, I put Cat Williams up there in that rarefied air also.
I'd put, for sculpting it, and other comedians would too, Seinfeld, I would put him close, even though he didn't talk about the same sort of, he didn't have sort of the pulse of important topics. He was doing more flimsy material.
Yeah, I've never like really checked out his stand-up, but I am amazed and impressed. Like, I know there's a movie about it, I need to check that, when he just stripped his act all the way down and decided to build it back up.
You need to check out that movie. Yeah, I think it's called Comedians. Yeah, and you see him in a kitchen in Cleveland, sort of hunched over, afraid to perform in front of, you know, 30 people, just because those comedians, they talk. You should, in that movie, there's a real poignant scene of Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock amazed by Bill Cosby, that Bill Cosby, because these things are so sculpted, because it's not improvisational. These guys are playing music up there, sometimes for memorization. They know where the laughs are supposed to go. They know how to hit the notes so that the laughs, they even pause for the laughs when the laughs aren't there because they're expecting the laughs. And so they marveled that Bill Cosby would just go up there and do 90 fresh minutes.
Yeah, Bill Cosby is like the O.J. Simpson of comedy in the sense that we get to listing who all these guys are who are like O.J. Simpson, who are the greatest running backs of all time. You'd be like, damn, there's this one dude. I can't. Who is that? We used to always put him right here on the list. Who is that guy? That's what Bill Cosby is like. I feel like I'm forgetting somebody.
I don't know how many of the people around here who have gotten used to listening to you on our show know just the depths of your musical expertise. You were a music critic before you were a sports persona. So where do you put Jack White in terms of history's guitarists? Because it's a short list, and he's the guy for the modern times.
Yeah, and he's almost kind of like an anachronism as being like a super duper guitar player in this day and age, right? Like this isn't really an era of bands where we have people who just jump out, where you talk about them as just being instrumentalists in a way that everybody knows if you mention his name. Like Eddie Van Halen just died. You don't have to listen to Van Halen to know when somebody talks about Eddie Van Halen, you're talking about a great guitar player. And Jack White is there. And Jack White's thing was, it was that great era of the early part of the first decade of the new millennium where it got lo-fi and grimy, right? Like I love My Morning Jacket, for example, from that time, because it got lo-fi and like nasty in a way that I enjoy my music being. And so I don't look at White, like where Van Halen, so much about Eddie Van Halen was, I think he was, Eddie's grooves and Eddie's riffs were what made him good. I don't enjoy Eddie Van Halen as a soloist, actually. I find his solos to be kind of aimless and just kind of showing off all the magic tricks that he can do with the guitar. And I feel like as white dudes started listening to music that wasn't made by black people, they started moving away from like the soul and grit of things and started moving more into, ooh, look at this cool trick that I can do, and start talking about technical expertise and a bunch of other shit that I don't really care about. I never felt like that's what it was about with Jack White. Like Jack White, that is music that's about a feeling by and large. And that's where he always gets me there. When I really like Jack White, it's about how it feels more so than how it sounds.
So the top of the list is in terms of making you, because you're going to go with the feels there, right? Like it's not.
Yeah. Like Jimi Hendrix is like, there's Hendrix. And then there's like everybody that like falls below it is no fault. Like Carlos Santana is incredible in that he could do so much of that technical stuff and is still like always like really felt like something. Tom Morello is the dude for me who can do all of the guitar tricks, but it still always has a very clear and distinct feeling as to what it is. So like, I think about a dude like Iommi and Black Sabbath, where to me, the feel of Black Sabbath is everybody but the guitar player, right? And then they just let him in. Granted, the dude's missing a couple of fingertips. It, you know, interferes with your ability to like get this done. And with Van Halen, I guess I always say I missed the point for a while because I would just always get so tired of people talking about those solos. And then you go and listen to how hard those grooves are. And you're like, okay, so this is what everything is actually about. Is this. Got it.
Bomani, good talking to you as always. Thank you, sir. Again, a reminder to all of you, if you enjoy this time with Bomani, there's more of it. The Right Time with Bomani Jones is something you need to be listening to. So find it wherever it is you get your podcast. Thank you, sir.
All right, man. Be good.